From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A vote is about to start on the Senate floor on a straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act. It's the latest in a series of votes taking place in Washington on the future of health care after the debate was opened up yesterday by a 51-50 procedural vote. For the latest, we're joined by Sarah Cliff, health policy reporter at Vox. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And this vote that we're waiting on is a repeal-only plan. It is expected to be defeated. Where does the health care bill stand right now after yesterday and today's votes?
Yeah, it's been a busy and somewhat confusing few days here in Washington. So where we are right now is last night around 9 p.m., the Senate voted down the Better Care Reconciliation Act, which was essentially the Senate's plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. They are expected any minute now to vote on a straight repeal, as you mentioned, Jeremy. After that, we kind of move into a little more unpredictable territory where we're expecting a lot of amendments to be offered, some offered by Democrats, some by Republicans. And ultimately, we're expecting this all to converge on a vote on something that's being called skinny repeal, which would be a very watered down repeal where you would only get rid of the individual mandate and a few taxes.
But we should remind people that the individual mandate is one of the reasons that Obamacare works the way it does, right? Because everybody has to have insurance.
Yes, I think that's a good point to make. Even though we're calling it skinny repeal, the ramifications would be quite large. When the Congressional Budget Office analyzed a bill similar to this one in 2015, they estimated that 15 million people would lose coverage. And a lot of that, as you mentioned, is because of the expected instability in the individual market. If there is no mandate for healthy people to buy coverage, most of us expect that only the sick people would stick around in that market and premiums would go up quite significantly.
Does skinny repeal have support among enough Republicans?
That is a fantastic question. I think Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is trying to figure that out right now. The idea only came up on Monday, so it's only been floating around Capitol Hill, maybe at most 36 hours at this point. But that is the hope that the Senate can move it, or Mitch McConnell's hope that he can move this kind of smaller, watered-down package and at least go to conference, which would mean that the House and the Senate set up a conference committee where they hash out the details of a final Obamacare repeal bill.
And we don't have a Congressional Budget Office score on the skinny repeal, right? We don't know how many people would lose their coverage.
We don't know that. The bill doesn't exist as actual legislative text. Right now, it's just a few bullet points. But as I mentioned, in 2015, CBO did analyze a bill that was very similar to skinny repeal. And CBO found that 15 million fewer people would have coverage and premiums in the individual market would rise by 20%.
Now, yesterday, we had the dramatic return of Senator John McCain to the Senate floor. He's dealing with brain cancer. And let's listen to a little bit of what he said.
I voted for the motion to proceed to allow debate to continue and amendments to be offered. I will not vote for this bill as it is today.
So he said that to applause. And then a few hours later, he did end up voting for the Senate health care bill. How do we square that?
He did. His office has put out a statement on this. They say it was a procedural vote, and technically they're correct. It was a procedural vote. But I think all of us, you know, fairly interpreted these votes that happened last night about whether or not you want to move forward with the Better Care Reconciliation Act, this bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. So it was a little bit surprising to see Senator McCain, you know, vote in favor of that bill and to vote to open the debate. He gave, you know, this very lengthy speech yesterday where he really criticized the partisanship, the lack of committee hearings, the lack of process around the repeal bill. But he still voted to open debate. He, you know, could have said, no, you know, we need to go back to the drawing board. We need to move this through committees, bring it to the floor the right way. But in voting to open debate, he is somewhat complicit in this process the Republicans have created.
And is there any expectation about whether he will vote for a final bill at the end of this process?
That's a big unknown at this point. I haven't seen him talking much about the skinny repeal idea, whether he would back it. It seems like he would not vote the Better Care Reconciliation Act, the big repeal and replace, out of this debate. But I haven't seen him or many other senators rule out the idea of voting something out of this debate sometime this week.
Just a few seconds left here. But is it possible that everything that's going on the floor of the Senate is just kind of a sideshow and there's some backroom deal happening?
It's possible, but I think senators are pretty preoccupied by the Senate floor now. It would be hard to be running those backroom deals, but they're probably talking to a few holdout senators off the floor to see what they can get them on board with.
That's Sarah Cliff, Vox health policy reporter. Sarah, thanks as always.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, today, President Trump continued his attacks on Attorney General Jeff Sessions, tweeting that Sessions should have replaced the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, because, paraphrasing, McCabe's wife has ties to Democrats. Now, McCabe stepped up after James Comey was fired. The president also recently blamed Sessions for Robert Mueller taking over the Russia investigation because Sessions recused himself. And yesterday, the president blamed Sessions for leaks, then said this.
I told you before, I'm very disappointed with the attorney general, but we will see what happens. Time will tell. Time will tell.
What might time tell? Trump's critics suspect his goal is to fire Sessions to clear the way to remove Robert Mueller. Can he do that? Steve Fladek is a law professor at the University of Texas in Austin and co-editor-in-chief of the blog Just Security. Professor, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And now in your post, you write about three possible scenarios. The first is if Sessions is fired or quits and President Trump doesn't act at all. In that case, the current deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, will become acting attorney general, would have any role in firing Mueller. People don't think that this is the realistic conclusion to this drama that we're in right now. But if Rosenstein were to fire Mueller, would Congress have to approve that?
Not necessarily. I mean, the way that the special counsel regulation is set up, the same person who hired Mueller, which in this case is indeed Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, has the authority to terminate him for cause, for neglect, for other specified purposes. The working assumption, though, is that Rod Rosenstein is not going to fire Mueller, you know, for political reasons. He'd only do it for substantive reasons.
Right. Well, that brings us to the second possibility, which is based on the Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998. You write that the president might be able to use this law to appoint someone other than Rosenstein should Sessions quit, but the option might not be available if President Trump fires Jeff Sessions.
Well, there's some unclarity about this. I mean, the vacancies reform statute specifically says that when someone like the attorney general dies, resigns, or is otherwise unable to discharge the duties of his office, the president has some more options in who he can appoint on a temporary acting basis, usually for no more than 7 months. The real question is whether otherwise unable to discharge the duties of his office encompasses also being fired. I think folks could argue that both ways. It's very possible we could see a challenge if that is indeed the route President Trump goes, if and when it comes time to pick a temporary successor for Jeff Sessions.
Right. So Donald Trump has been laying out the case that he doesn't believe that Jeff Sessions is fulfilling his job. But in that case as well, would he have to have congressional approval for firing Jeff Sessions?
No, I mean, he doesn't need any approval to fire Jeff Sessions. And indeed, he doesn't need any approval to hire someone on a temporary basis to serve as the acting attorney general. Under the Vacancies Reform Act, he can choose among anyone who has already been confirmed by the Senate to any position in the federal government. He can also choose among particular senior officials at the Justice Department who have been there for at least 90 days, who hold a certain stature of office.
But who gets to question if they feel that President Trump is misusing this law by saying that Sessions hadn't fulfilled his obligations?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that if President Trump does use the Vacancies Reform Act after firing Sessions, someone who is subjected to some kind of coercive action by the new acting attorney general could object that the acting attorney general was not appointed lawfully. So this could very well end up in the courts. I think this is part of why we're seeing pressure from the White House, from President Trump, to try to get Sessions to resign. If he resigns, any debate over this question goes away.
Right. But we also have a third possible scenario, the recess appointment. If the Senate is in recess for 10 days or more, the president can appoint a replacement who would serve until the end of the next Senate session. That's January 2019.
Well, so the first scenario, as we were discussing, is only for a short-term temporary acting successor. A recess appointment would actually be a sort of intermediate-term successor who actually would not be the acting attorney general, but would be the attorney general. And if the president is able to make that appointment while the Senate is in a constitutional recess, he could pick anybody. He could pick you. He could pick me. He could pick Jared Kushner. And that person would be the attorney general through January 2019. That's a pretty big power. I think that's part of why we heard earlier this week Chuck Schumer, other Democrats, saying they're going to do everything within their power to prevent the Senate from actually going into a formal recess.
But just stay with the possibility the president might make a recess appointment. If that recess appointment of attorney general fires Mr. Mueller, in the Russia investigation. Does Congress have recourse there?
I mean, Congress always has recourse. And I think this is perhaps the most important takeaway to the Trump session saga. At the end of the day, the president has a whole lot of authority over his own subordinates, including the attorney general. The real question is whether there's a red line here where if the president crosses it, he's finally going to motivate and impel congressional Republicans especially to push back more aggressively, to perhaps withhold confirmation of other executive branch nominees like the FBI director, to ratchet up their own investigations of Russia and of the White House. I think it's a very delicate political calculus, even if the legal authorities tilt pretty heavily in the president's favor.
That's Steve Vladeck, professor at the University of Texas School of Law and Austin, co-editor-in-chief of the blog Just Security. We'll post it at herenow.org. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Just last week, the coastal city of Imperial Beach, California, joined two other coastal counties in California, Marin and San Mateo, in announcing they're suing more than three dozen big oil, gas, and coal companies to help pay for the damages caused by climate change, pointing to the emissions the companies directly produced and the cover-up at least one company undertook. After President Trump announced U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, mayors across the country signed pledges to honor and uphold the goals of that accord. The mayor of Imperial Beach did that as well. But in addition to hiring a group to plan how to deal with the future impact of climate change, he's now concerned with who's paying for it. Serge Dudina is the mayor of Imperial Beach. Mayor Dudina, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And your city near the Mexican border there is surrounded by water, three sides. You've got the San Diego Bay, the Tijuana Estuary, and the Pacific Ocean. So how are you seeing sea level rise in particular?
Yeah, you know, I've been obsessively documenting what's been happening on our coast since I'm a surfer, since I was a kid in 1977. I've been in my city that long, and so I'm 53 now. So I have a lot of data, memory data backed up basically to really look at what's been happening on our coast. And the last few years, especially with El Nino, we've seen the worst coastal flooding that we've ever seen in our history, especially on our bayfront. But we have the south end of what's called Seacoast Drive, our beachfront drive, is basically filled with water most of the winter. And that's what the Unit of Concerned Scientists have just called in a recent report, chronic inundation. So what you're seeing in Virginia and in Florida, you're also seeing in places like Imperial Beach. So it really sort of woke us up to the reality of what's going to be coming at us with a report that we commissioned to look at the impacts of sea level rise on our city.
Well, and so you're seeing an even worse impact in the future. But how do you think a lawsuit against these companies is going to work? Because, as you know, the Alaskan village of Kivalina has been hit with violent storms associated with melting sea ice. Some of these villages in Alaska are scheduled to disappear. In 2008, that village sued oil and coal companies to pay for relocation costs. They lost.
Yeah, so we have a couple things going for us. First, we're working with some of the world's top scientists who've looked at the impact of carbon, what's called cumulative carbon. So they've actually measured the carbon put into the atmosphere by these companies. So they know that the carbon emissions from these corporations have accounted for a large percentage of the carbon in the environment over the last few decades. Number two, we have the smoking gun documents issued by companies like ExxonMobil, who ironically donated some of their documents to the University of Texas Library, where I got my PhD at the University of Texas. So a little happy about that, that connection. But basically, these companies in their documents acknowledge the impact of sea level rise and climate change, what would happen from their own activities, and talked about the need to change. Then they switched course and carried out their Merchants of Doubt campaign, which has resulted now in our current administration basically pulling out of the Paris agreements and just basically doubting that climate change and sea level rise is something that's happening.
Well, in these documents that you're talking about, you're referring to some of the work by the nonprofit journalism group Inside Climate News, working with the Los Angeles Times. They found that ExxonMobil and other, you know, big players conducted this internal research going back to the 1980s. They knew about ties between fossil fuels and climate change. There's a chain of emails and documents showing that. You've got state attorneys general in New York and Massachusetts investigating whether ExxonMobil did what these documents appear to show, you know, knew one thing, but as you said another, even though internally they knew about the impact of climate change. And you've got ExxonMobil shareholders filing a class action lawsuit saying that the company misled them on the financial risks associated with climate change. So you got all that going for you. But still, you know, you have people like Michael Berger, who studies climate change law at Columbia University, saying that particular emissions came from particular companies That's a long chain of causation. That's a tough legal case.
Yeah, you know, we're a tough town, and we'll take our chances in court because the reality is we have no chance with rising seas. We have to spend tens and tens of millions of dollars. You know, about 30% of our city will be impacted by coastal flooding in the future. We'll lose 90% of our Seacoast Drive. Two elementary schools won't be impacted. And just the cost of moving a sewer line inland will cost us $10 million soon. So we're not too worried about a court case. We're really more worried about the real world of sea level rise that we have to face and these corporate polluters cost.
A couple things. You know what the industry has long said. This is something like the attacks on the tobacco industry that ended up being successful. But for the longest time, the tobacco industry could separate themselves with what people did with their products. Here, the oil industry is saying, unlike tobacco use, there's no direct connection between energy companies and global warming's effects on individual people. In between, there were cars, you know, the car industry that didn't consider emissions as soon as they should have. There are lawmakers who dismissed any notion and still do of man-made climate change. So the oil industry is saying, well, no, we're quite far removed from this problem, unlike the tobacco industry, which was direct to consumers.
Yeah, you know, again, we're a simple blue-collar city, and we don't have real complicated and fancy communications experts and corporate attorneys to spin climate, but we have seen the science. And, you know, we're in a reality-based state in California where we acknowledge and address the very real issue of climate change and sea level rise. And as a super cool, gorgeous beach town on the Mexican border, we think it's important that cities like ours take responsibility and hold these corporate polluters responsible, but more importantly, make sure they pay the cost of the very real harm they're doing to cities like ours and hopefully cities across the country and the planet.
That's Imperial Beach, California Mayor Serge Dudina. His city has filed a lawsuit against fossil fuel companies to collect damages for the impact of climate change. Mayor Dudina, we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, the mayor is also executive director of Wild Coast. That's a nonprofit environmental group. And he says the law firm Cher Edling is absorbing the cost of that lawsuit. And we contacted the Western States Petroleum Association, an industry group, for a response. They tell us in a statement that they are aware of the lawsuit, are monitoring the situation closely, but do not comment on active litigation. Well, it's summer, open season for ice cream, milkshakes, popsicles. But if you eat them too fast, brain freeze. I know, a small problem. But understanding why our heads ache after a little too much rocky road sets the basis for understanding new pain research. Ashley Stevens from Here and Now contributor WFPL explains the science behind the ice cream headache.
On a recent day, when temperatures were soaring into the 90s, I stopped by the Comfy Cow ice cream parlor in Louisville with a simple question.
So what if I asked you to eat your ice cream really, really fast? What would you say?
I wouldn't really like to.
No, thank you.
It wasn't a popular request.
Why would you say that?
Because I would worry about getting a brain freeze.
Because I might get a brain freeze.
Ah, the brain freeze. The signature pain of summer, experienced by anyone who has eaten ice cream with too much enthusiasm or slurped down a slushie a little too quickly. Have you ever stopped mid-freeze to think about why our bodies react like this? Well, researchers who study pain have, and some, like Dr. Chris Rao of the University of Louisville, say brain freeze is a good way to understand the basics of how we process damaging stimuli.
There's a scientific medical term for ice cream addicts, which is sphenopalatine ganglion neuralgia.
Try breaking that out at your next ice cream social.
It doesn't impress everybody, but some people.
To understand how brain freeze happens, it helps to think of your body and brain as a big computer where everything is hooked together. In this case, you see an ice cream truck. You decide to indulge and soon dive face first into a double scoop of mint chocolate chip.
Now, in the roof of your mouth, there's a lot of little blood vessels, capillaries, and there's a lot of little nerve fibers. They're called nociceptors that they detect painful or noxious stimuli.
The rush of cold causes those vessels to constrict.
When that happens, it happens so quickly that all of those little pain fibers in the roof of your mouth, they interpret that as being a painful stimulus.
A message is then shot up to your brain via the trigeminal nerve, the nerve responsible for sensation in the face. The brain itself doesn't have any pain-sensing fibers, but its covering, called the meninges, does.
And, of course, all of those little pain-sensing fibers are hooked up to your trigeminal nerve, and the brain is trying to figure out what is going on. It knows that there's something wrong and that there's something that's painful. They don't exactly know where it is.
and the pain message finally registers at the top of your head, which seems kind of random, but...
It's a very similar phenomenon to the referred pain that is experienced by people that have heart attacks. So you don't feel like your heart is hurting itself, it's your shoulder that's starting to hurt on your left side.
And most importantly, it's enough to get most people to stop eating the ice cream. Crisis averted. And after a minute or two, the body and brain go back to normal. But what about chronic pain that lasts longer, like days or weeks or months? That's what Rao's lab is interested in researching. Rao says there are a lot of contributing factors for chronic pain. He's most interested in the long-term effects of tissue damage, for example. But when it comes down to it, chronic pain is just like ice cream headaches. It's all in your head.
Then the brain is what actually interprets all those signals that are coming in and determines whether it's painful or not painful. So without the brain, there would be no pain.
And understanding this is helping Rao and his colleagues develop new drugs that could be used to treat pain even before it happens. But back to ice cream headaches for a minute. As much as they hurt, Rao says there is anecdotal evidence suggesting that brain freeze might be an effective treatment for migraines. It doesn't work for everyone, and the reasons why it might work are unclear. But for those who have to deal with the debilitating effects of migraines, he says it might be worth giving it a tasty shot. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Stevens in Louisville.
Well now, ice cream man, up on my street, I heard your truck outside is really neat. Ice cream man, up on my block, your little chimes, they reel and they rock.
Jonathan Richman, I think in his bedroom, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson. President Trump tweeted earlier today that he will ban transgender people from serving in the military. He tweeted, "Our military, quote, cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption." Currently, 18 other countries allow transgender people to serve openly in the military, including the UK, Australia, and Canada. Joining us now is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, first of all, what are the immediate effects of this for transgender people who are serving now? Do they have to leave their posts?
That's a very good question, Jeremy. We don't know. All we have right now is a tweet from the president basically saying that after consulting with his generals, he said that the U.S. government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. So it sounds like those serving would be forced out, which raises all sorts of legal questions, of course. And the Pentagon, interestingly, is referring all questions to the White House on a military matter.
Well, how many transgender people are currently serving in the military?
Well, no one has a good firm number. There's been estimates by the RAND Corporation of about 2,500 in the active force and another 1,500 in the reserves. And this, the total size of the military is about 1.3 million. So it's relatively small. But again, this June of last year, then Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that transgender individuals will now be able to openly serve in the armed forces. He said at the time, quote, "This is the right thing to do for our people and for the force." He said, "We're talking about talented Americans who are serving with distinction or who want the opportunity to serve. We can't allow barriers unrelated to a person's qualifications to prevent us from recruiting and retaining those who can best accomplish the mission." And what the president is saying today is, after consulting with his senior generals, that there was a cost issue involved here, the tens of thousands of dollars needed for the various medical procedures. But again, we're talking a very relatively small number of people, so
right,
there's no sense of the actual cost involved here. So again, a lot of questions that we just don't have answers to at this point.
Well, what's been the response so far?
Well, the response has been pretty swift from Democrats, a ranking Democrat in Armed Services called this disgraceful. The ACLU called it outrageous. And then Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who, of course, announced that transgender individuals would be allowed to openly serve in the armed forces, he sent out a statement today saying, listen, transgender people are now serving honorably. And this also sends the wrong signal to the younger generation of people you're trying to attract into the military. So harsh criticism, since this was announced by the president by a tweet.
And this was a surprise, it sounds like.
It was a surprise because last month, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis approved a recommendation from the services that would defer bringing in transgender applicants into the military. He said, we're going to hold off on bringing in new transgender people until January 1st of 2018. We want to review, he said, the impact on readiness and lethality. So that's what we had from the Pentagon just a few weeks ago. And then the president jumps in this morning and says, we're just going to pull the plug on all of this.
That's NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, and we'll continue to follow this story as it develops. Tom, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
This fall, students at the University of Michigan will have a new way of getting around campus. Two self-driving shuttles will cover a 2-mile route, first of any campus in the country. It's a partnership with M-City, the 32-acre testing facility at the university. We paid a visit a while back during the Michigan primaries. We'll link it here now.org. At the time, our colleague Mickey Maynard drove around with Wei Penn, mechanical engineering director of M-City. He joins us again. Hello.
Hi.
So tell us more about these shuttles. No gas pedals, no steering wheels. How are they run?
So autonomous vehicles operate largely in two different ways, in generally speaking. Number one is fixed route. We map the route in advance, driving very slowly, collecting a lot of data. The second type would be free routing. You can literally go anywhere there's a road on the map.
Yeah.
So these shuttles largely rely on the GPS, the pre-planned route.
So this shuttle will be responding to all the coordinates you've already put in.
That's correct.
Well, okay. The first question is, because these are students who are going to be using the shuttle, students often are equated with pranks. Are you at all concerned about safety?
Absolutely. So we understand that some students might be inspired to set the world record in piling into this shuttle and set the U.S. Record. Therefore, in the beginning, we will have a safety conductor on board. To deploy these shuttles in the community used by real users, including students, it is very important that we take a very cautious approach. So these safety conductors not only will watch and make sure that the vehicle operates safely, it will also watch human behavior and make sure that people come on board using these shuttles safely.
Yeah, well, it's part of a research project. So, people are going to be observing in a lot of different ways. We're reading that it will be picking up data as it operates. Something called LIDAR is used. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's correct.
Yeah, and what does that do?
So LIDAR stands for laser detection and range. Basically, it shoots out laser beams. The accuracy is fantastic. Usually, it's below an inch. So these LIDARs will be used to detect any subjects, even very small ones like traffic cones.
We understand these electric shuttles were made by the French company Navya. How do they know, when to start and stop? How do they know when everybody's on board?
These vehicles have been programmed to drive safely, to follow the route, and to avoid any obstacles, road users. On the other hand, whether these vehicles can safely detect everybody who want to come on board or people who want to disembark, therefore the safety conductor as part of this experiment will take that responsibility. In the future, when we have enough confidence that this is operating safely, we will either use sensors or use remote monitors, operators. But during this experiment in the coming year, we'll have one safety conductor on board for each shuttle.
And why is it better? I can remember in school, probably people can, even in school now, the person who would drive the shuttle or the bus, becomes somebody you care about on your college campus and somebody you get to know.
So robots may not be better than human in every aspect, but they have beaten the best chess champion. We know that robots are always programmed to learn and improve. They never got distracted. They don't text. They don't get drunk. Mm. They don't get angry. So we think that robot drivers eventually will be better than even the best human drivers.
What are you hearing on campus? Are people excited about this, nervous about it? What are you hearing?
I think there will always be people who are excited and also people who are concerned. I think both are right. They all have good points.
Well, Professor Penn, I mentioned that these shuttles were created in France, but they're not going to have a production line here?
They are. They just announced that they are going to have a production line in Michigan, actually very close to the University of Michigan.
Hui Peng, professor of engineering at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also the director of MCity, and that's where they are researching driverless cars. These driverless shuttles will be on campus in September. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Back to healthcare. President Trump has promised to lower insurance costs, but so far plans from House and Senate Republicans include policies that encourage higher deductibles and raise out-of-pocket costs. Meanwhile, the number of people with these high-deductible health plans is growing, and research shows many are putting off medical treatment because of that cost. Pauline Bartoloni from our partner Kaiser Health News took a look.
For Jennifer Brown and her husband Mike, getting health care is not as simple as doing what the doctor says. They always consider the cost.
It's really about weighing what's worth it and what's not worth it.
Mike makes a comfortable salary as an IT manager, but Jennifer's not working right now. She just finished school and hopes to start a new career. For that, the family's in the middle of an expensive move to another city where they hope there are better job prospects. So this year, the Browns came to the difficult decision to delay certain medical treatments because of the price. Jennifer Brown has degenerative disc disease in her back, and when it flares up, she's in a lot of pain.
The next day, I know I'm going to hurt, or I'm going to have a hard time falling asleep at night, or staying asleep, you know, walking funny, you know, when you get out of bed and you're all hunched over, grabbing your back like an 80-year-old woman.
Steroid shots could help. But she figures that would be at least $1,000. That's because the family's health insurance, which they get through her husband's job, comes with a $3,500 deductible.
It's just not worth it. I have to deal with the pain and find other ways around it.
Jennifer Brown says her family had to put off a recommended test for her husband's acid reflux, and they will not be buying a breathing machine she needs to treat her sleep apnea.
But right now, we're choosing to look the other way because it's not in our budget. So I guess we're waiting for things to get really, really bad before we decide to go.
A recent survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 43% of insured people have a hard time paying their deductible. Another study by Families USA found that more than a quarter of people in high-deductible health plans delayed some type of medical care, such as a doctor's visit or a diagnostic test. That's no surprise to Dr. Ted Mazur, a head and neck surgeon in San Diego, California.
People who have medical problems that can be put off, they tend to put them off much more now because of the high deductible.
Mazur is president-elect of the California Medical Association. He says he sees patients put off all kinds of treatment.
I've had instances where things really were not elective, and yet people faced with their high deductibles said, no, I can't do it. And I have to make the phone call and say, we're looking at a mass that may be malignant. And if you put it off, you're putting yourself at risk. And I'll tell you, we've had people take that risk.
The trouble is, Mazur says, it's hard for patients to know what care they need and what they can do without.
But if they're putting off something that might be serious, that's a danger. Yeah, you may save some dollars today. What's it going to cost you in the future, both in your health and dollars down the road?
Harvard researchers recently looked into that question. They found that low-income diabetes patients in high-deductible plans put off visits to their doctor and often wound up getting more expensive emergency room care.
If the deductibles go up, it diminishes the value of insurance.
Sabrina Corlett of the Georgetown Center on Health Insurance Reform says the growth of high-deductible health plans is likely to continue whether or not Obamacare is repealed. and that undermines the two main purposes of insurance.
It is supposed to help you access healthcare services so that the doctors that you need and want to see are willing and able to see you. But it's also a financial protection, right? It is supposed to protect you from medical bankruptcy or otherwise if you have something really serious go wrong with you.
Jennifer Brown in Michigan says her family's $3,500 deductible isn't working for her. That's because she has to decide whether she can afford to get the medical treatment that her doctors say she and her husband need.
I feel like this should be less of a family's issue and more of the insurance. I would really like to see it go back on the insurance. That's what we're paying for. And right now I feel like, you know, like I don't feel like I have any safety net at all, unless I'm really, really sick.
Relief for the Browns and other families with high deductible plans is unlikely to come anytime soon. Experts say until Congress addresses the root causes of high health care costs, more people will have to make painful choices about what care they can afford. For Here and Now, I'm Pauline Bartoloni in Sacramento.
Are you like the Browns? Let us know. HereandNow.org.
What's going on with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson? He's taking off for a few days, fueling rumors that he might be thinking of stepping down. There's even a new word making the rounds on Twitter, hashtag Rexit. But State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert says the secretary just took a few days off after a grueling trip to the Middle East and is now back to work with a lot on his plate.
The secretary has been very clear. He intends to stay here at the State Department. We have a lot of work that is left to be done ahead of us. He recognizes that. He's deeply engaged in that work. We have meetings scheduled. He has meetings scheduled for the rest of the week here in Washington. He does, however, serve at the pleasure of the president, just as any cabinet official would.
She dismissed the rumors as palace intrigue. Joining us now is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
And what about this? All these rumors about why Rex Tillerson is on vacation. Is it possible that there's going to be a Rexit?
Well, I mean, you know, people at the State Department don't seem to think so. They say he's hard at work, but he has expressed some frustrations with the job. I mean, his relationship with the White House is a little complicated. And during a recent trip to the Middle East, he told some reporters traveling with him that this isn't like what he's used to. He used to run ExxonMobil. He was CEO and the ultimate decider, ultimate decision maker. So this is really something new for him.
Well, let's talk about what he's actually been doing at the State Department. How do his priorities differ from Secretary of State John Kerry under President Obama?
Well, Kerry was sort of on the road all the time, trying to solve problems, liked his, you know, to show off his negotiating skills or what he thought were his negotiating skills. This is a guy, Tillerson, who's much more insular. He's been making a real focus on the reorganization of the State Department. He set September for the goal for this reorganization. And, you know, I have a hard time believing that he would leave any time before he at least gets that done.
When you say reorganization, some people hear that as cutbacks.
There are cutbacks. I mean, he's talking about as much as a 30% budget cut. He's also cutting back the number of special envoys, different offices. You know, to be fair, the State Department has a lot of these offices and overlapping positions with the kind of regular regional bureaus. So reorganizing that is something that has been done before. And, you know, and the State Department spokesperson insists that all of the functions will still continue just under different offices.
Tillerson and Trump have occasionally appeared to contradict each other, most recently on the issue of Qatar. Trump has publicly sided with the Saudis, who, along with the UAE and Egypt and Bahrain, are leading a blockade of Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. Tillerson is trying to get the Saudis and the others to end the blockade. What's that about? Why the difference between what we're hearing from the White House and what we're hearing from the State Department?
Well, Tillerson knows this region well. He especially Qatar, since he had done a lot of business with them. And he's trying to get all of these sides back to the negotiating table, talking to each other again, focused on the issues that the U.S. wants to focus on, which is fighting ISIS. But yes, I mean, you know, you'll have a tweet by President Trump or something else coming from the White House that undercuts what Tillerson is trying to do. There's a real dissonance often.
But this is the person that President Trump picked for the job after a big, very public search for a Secretary of State. What's the relationship like right now between the White House and Tillerson?
It's hard to get that kind of insight. I mean, Tillerson does meet often with President Trump, you know, and it's a question that Senator Corker was asked about today. He's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he's spoken to Tillerson often. And he says, you know, Tillerson has a very strong relationship with Defense Secretary Mattis, National Security Advisor McMaster, and that these are important foreign policy players in the White House that do get undercut sometimes from the White House, but they're trying to find their way. Let's hear a little bit of what he said.
I don't think Tillerson is on the verge of resigning. I don't see that. I think he understands how important the triumvirate that exists between he and Mattis and McMaster are for our nation today. He understands that, and I think he's willing to deal with all the things that exist to try to ensure that this administration and our nation is successful in foreign policy.
So that was Senator Corker just speaking this morning about these Brexit rumors at the Washington Post.
So how is all of this playing among the career diplomats at the State Department?
You know, the career diplomats, when Tillerson first came in, I think there was a sense of welcoming him. But, you know, people aren't really sure how he fits in with the White House and what he's really planning to do. I think there's a lot of moving pieces, but there's also been a very slow pace of hiring people at the State Department. So that's another area of conflict between the White House and Tillerson over who gets some of these jobs.
That's Michelle Kellerman, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.